So two exhibitions to consider there, Chaim Steinbach at Tanya Banakhtar and Leandro Ehrlich at Sean Kelly in New York, which perhaps the panel will or will not agree with me, represent experiences of commonplace, perhaps overlooked objects, transformed, transfigured, rendered unusual, strange, alienating, disconcerting, wondrous, weird, in different contexts than those one would normally encounter. Toys and dog chews and elevator shafts in. One doesn't associate those objects with an art gallery unless they are art. Ken, with Chaim Steinbach, do you get the sensation of an artist who is inviting us to look with greater depth and sympathy at objects that might otherwise be overlooked? Or do you get the stronger feeling of an artist playing some game with taste? Perhaps poking fun at the objects that he's brought together. What kind of relationship does Steinbach engender in relation to the objects he selects?
Well, it's for one thing, it's between sort of popular culture or kitsch culture and high culture, with the minimalist shelves. I guess you find yourself thinking, what would these look like without the objects on the shelves? You could have a whole career just doing that. But to me, it kind of raises the question, like, that these things that he presents on the shelves, most of them, are extraordinarily attractive and sort of electrifying sometimes, as even at the same time as they're kind of stupid looking. And to me, that's the mystery of it. He's been doing that for 20 years, and it never gets old. And I don't know if it alters taste, but it does sort of make you think about what's attractive visually.
Yes. Carly, do you feel it's more the individual object, the assemblage, or something that's meta, beyond anything that's seen, that it's all about?
Well, there's definitely something about his own sensibility that comes through, his own affection for these objects. I mean, it is a very curated assembly, but it takes, it took me a few steps to realize that the dog chew toys were dog chew toys, and then you look at them again, of course, as these elegant, minimal objects, and you wonder who designed the dog chew toy. But in the, as Ken notes, he's been doing this for so long, he's had this great affection for these, throwaway objects for, I remember seeing something he did actually at Gavin Brown, maybe, I won't say how long ago, but it was actually, instead of being the shelves without the objects, it was the objects without the shelves. So you had them just strewn about a table. And they had a similar effect of this bizarrely curated junk store that, transcended the objects beyond junk, which other people do. But there's something in his... in his affection for them and very specific choices that transforms the objects and ourselves, of course. But I felt that the tension in the show was right where Ken put it, of the objects on these minimalist shelves, and I still don't know if he actually makes Jed look better in these very they're made with plywood rather than metal, or if he should leave the objects to themselves again. There's this tension, and in the other shows as well, between the access that these artists now have to opulence, if they so choose, and they are constantly negotiating, it seems, how much of their you know, these are all established artists, how much of their access to wealth they want to put in their shows, especially if you're elevating degraded objects. Mm-hmm. So I would go at this moment with the idea that he's doing a nice offhand Judd, the way his objects are also offhand elevations of impoverished objects.
Yeah. Right. Yes. Carly mentions Judd, Ellie. The minimalist or artist who comes to my mind is more Artschwager, the fusion of the element of pop with the element of the streamlined, the reductive, because the shelves, you would expect a kind of dichotomy between shelf and what's on the shelf, but in fact the shelf itself has a kind of kitsch element, doesn't it?
It does. I think I would have rather seen an Artschwager show, however. I don't know if the tension that Carly mentions really gripped me. I saw the show twice, and I'm afraid to say I was rather left cold both times. The objects didn't strike me as compelling as they did to Ken, and I'm not sure exactly what that was, whether it was the combination of, as you said, the pop elements that make up the shelves, or I simply was not interested in the objects, or the combination of the objects. But a friend of mine who is an artist who really liked the show and I were talking about it, and he said the reason he liked it was he paid no attention to any conceptual implications by any of the anything that we've really just been talking about, that he really just liked that he felt that he was in the artist's mind. And so I think either for this show, either you like being in the artist's mind or you didn't. I'm afraid I didn't.
Yes, I confess that I don't either. And I also would want to talk to your friend and say, if there's nothing conceptual to think about, but you feel you're in the artist's mind, then what kind of mind is it? Is he really an artist? Because an artist's mind should always have things in it that are conceptual. Ken, the objects of intrinsic interest, that's just a difference of matter of taste. I mean, if you feel that the dog he chews, and Carly as well, if you feel the objects do have significance and sort of beauty or curiosity, then I think Ellie and I should be envious of you.
I look at dog chews differently now.
Yes. Well, I've just used too many dog chews, not on myself, but on my dog. In fact, I was curious to know, did he put any peanut butter in the dog chew? That would have taken it perhaps to a different level. But, Ken, clearly, conceptually, something is going on, right? There's the shelf and there's the objects. Are the objects in a dynamic relationship with them? Are they still do they have the tension or symbolism or drama of a still life object?
Well, originally when he started making this in the 80s, he was associated with that term neo-geo, which was Jeff Koons, who taking shiny objects and presenting them, inviting us to look at them the way that we look at artworks. Mm-hmm. Not that they are artworks, but what if you look at them that way, with a kind of hyper receptivity. So in one way, one concept that's going on in Steinbach's works is he's saying, here's two, you have these commercial objects and you have these shelves, and these are commercial objects that he's selling artworks that are commodities. So I don't know if anybody I mean, it's interesting that we didn't start out talking about that part, because that was the hot issue in the 80s, and now I guess we don't worry so much about commodification. But also those objects that he's presented, each represents, embodies some kind of long-term thinking in the world of design and toy making, and you know, the dog chew toys make you think of Rancusi. I'm sure that's obvious. So you have two different kinds of intense sophistication that are juxtaposed. And yeah, I think they animate two different parts of your mind. One is the child. I mean, you know, your inner child, that day-glow green frog just like, thrills me when I look at it. And so it invites you to wonder how is art playing on us, and how does our minds reverberate in response? I find it delightful, and especially the single green monster in the in the Robert Morris room.
Yes.
And you know, that dichotomy between the Puritanism and the white supremacist kind of idea, and the kind of beast coming up from the muck, the Freudian muck, and you know, there's a sense of kind of trying to integrate these spheres of consciousness that our education system tends to insist on keeping separate.
Yes. Well, I mean, I think you hit, historically for me, you hit the nail on the head with the reference to Kuhn's. To me, he is as a Kuhn's light, which is possibly
I would say he's actually not Kuhn's light, but perhaps purer than Kuhn's, in that he has never tried to... he elevates the materials for what they are, and he does not gild them. And I think that there's something very pure in that. And so therefore, I felt a little off-put by some of the writings on the walls. I felt that those tried to do more than was necessary. And, you know, perhaps some artists are very good writers and some are not.
Right. but the piece Creature that's on the second floor that Ken so eloquently described is a very stark juxtaposition of minimal and pop art, or the superego and the id, if you like, the coming together. But it seemed actually the most ambitious work in the show, and I was kind of pleased that he's going beyond the shelf. It's off the shelf, you could say, but it's also out of the box, as it were. Too many metaphors there, but at the same time, actually, it's the dichotomy is so obvious. It's there right from the get-go in his career, and that's why I mean, if it's irresponsible to say he's a footnote to Kuhn's, he's a Siamese twin of Kuhn's, because those two artists, and I suppose Hearst would be their godson. Really, it's just this collision of pure minimal box and kitsch detritus inside it.
I think he's different from... I mean, Kuhn's and Steinbach seem similar to me in that what they do comes out of love. I think they love... They're not... There's no mockery in what they're doing, as there is in Hearst.
Do we all feel that, Deli? Do you feel there's any mockery? Is he sort of having a dig at proletarian American taste? Or do you think he's an absolutely pure, genuine love for every object he finds?
I actually couldn't decide. I pondered that very question a lot while I was researching and preparing for this panel. And sorry, my mind is wandering a little bit back to the creature from the Black Lagoon.
Yes.
Because every time I went upstairs in the gallery and looked at that installation, I kept thinking how funny that this creature emerged from the swamp and created Robert Morris artworks. I don't know if anyone else thought that, but I simply couldn't let go of that image once.
Perhaps
you know.
It tells us where Robert Morris
came out of the slime, and this is what he did.
Well, he did come out of the slime of abstract expressionism. This is where minimal art comes from. It got rid of the mess and the effluvia, the id. I mean, you know, you go from de Kooning to Robert Morris, you've cleaned your act up. But then if you go back to pop appropriation, it's a bit more slime, right? But it's a clean slime.
Yeah, there's pop and there's pop, or there's appropriation and there's an appropriation. So.
Yes.
I think that there was a... Oh, sorry.
Well, Carly's saying, you know, Carly's insisting on quality. There's pop and there's pop. There's appropriation. So
I think I'm the same mind as Ken on this, is that there is just this affection. It's not tongue in cheek. It's not the exotic, you know, unknown of, you know, Pennsylvania gift, you know, kids shops or something. You know, mm-hmm. It's not foraging for something that you're not. That seems very, for whatever reason, the objects are tied to something important to him.
Okay.
Do you want to go on?
If you have something else to say.
No, I think that in a way there's this, like in the 60s when the pop artists started appropriating material from pop culture, there was still this clear distinction between high art and low culture. So that it upset people to bring that into the art realm, but it was still clear who was on top. And I think in decades that followed, separation became increasingly difficult and to believe in. And then from the 60s on, pop culture and started to, I think artists started looking at pop culture and thinking it's more imaginative than we are. It's more exciting, it's more interesting, movies, music. And now that high-low hierarchy for people younger than myself, I don't think exists at all. And I don't know, Steinbeck's closer to my age, and so there's perhaps a sort of almost a nostalgia for that separation. And
I think that might be either idealistic or pessimistic to think that people as young as the rest of us on this panel, but let me ask Ellie, I can be so personal, you are the youngest, I believe. Maybe not, I don't know. No? Well,
we're both ladies, you really can't win this one.
Yeah, okay, before that, strike that. let me ask Carly and Ellie, as the youngest members of the panel, if they would confirm or refute Ken's assertion that to your tender generation, there's no ability to discriminate between high and low or see appropriation as appropriation. Is that what you're really saying?
Yeah. Well, that the hierarchy is not clear.
The hierarchy is obscured now. Yeah. Is the hierarchy obscured between high art and kitsch?
I think I'm speaking for an older generation, but I think it's not that it is. I think thanks to so many artists, in fact, though. It's not that Steinbeck's the only one doing this.
It's a horde, isn't it?
Right, yeah. And in fact, I can think of many examples that I felt were much more condescending. So I think that thanks to so many artists and to the, you know, to the expansion of the idea of media, but the art continues to reinforce high and low, even, you know, this costs a certain amount.
Yes, yes. To me, it seems that artists appropriating objects and then putting them into play in the gallery in artworks is so well established, at least they've been doing it for a century, that it can't have face value anymore. It seems to me that it's almost no more remarkable for an artist to go and find tchotchkes and put them into play in an artwork than it is for an artist to get Winsor & Newton or Williamsburg tubes of paint and smear them and squeeze them onto a palette. I mean, this is a palette. We've had so long to look at appropriation art and installation art that it's got to be that it's good if you're looking at a bronze or a marble to be forced to think about bronze and marble, but for the most part, bronze and marble are kind of transparent when you're looking at a sculpture, and you look at the sculpture. So we should look at the relationships, the internal dynamics within a Haim Steinbach to decide how it's working, whether it's working, what's going on. It seems very strange to me to still be really thinking about appropriation.
Well, I think the aesthetics that are in the shelves and the aesthetics of the things presented on the shelves are very consistent in a broader view of visual culture. You know, you've got the Degas reproductions in these boxes that are themselves sculptures, and so if you begin to sort of tease out further out the implications of what he's talking about, you get more this sense of what is 20th century consciousness, and we set up these categories of high, low, art, non art, pop art, you know, and those are fine, but there may be something that he's sort of instinctively getting at that isn't sort of doctrinaire art historical thinking.
I think it is an interesting contrast. Again, you know, I'm not sure whether I believe this show is entirely successful in this department, but I think, Ken, you're right that what's interesting about it is the combination of the two different sort of modes of art making. There's, you know, the minimalist, very traditional, which is the shelves, and then the making art out of non-art materials. It's almost as though in each work he's fused two completely different ideologies, and maybe that's, you know, why it's confusing to some and successful and interesting to others.
Well, I just like the way they look. You know, it kind of comes down to that.
That's a good place to start and maybe also end. So, Ellie, Leandro Ehrlich, here we have, I can't detect any forced dichotomies. This is a very both literal and followed through appropriation, or maybe appropriation. I think appropriation is the wrong word. It is a, it is what it is. Tell us what you did with the elevator.
Well,
where did it take you?
Actually, this was rather a funny story. Before leaving work, the day that I went to the opening of Leandro Ehrlich's show, I got stuck in the elevator. So I went to the opening and was fortunate enough to meet the artist, and I told him the story. I said, you know, I actually just got stuck in the elevator before coming here, and he was rather pleased that I had sort of started the show early, he said. So I may have been really in a particularly appropriate frame of mind to experience the show, but what I loved about it, as opposed to really being stuck in the elevator, was that it transported you to a sort of a completely different place. There were people interacting with each other. It was like going to an amusement park almost. I had conversations with people in every artwork. People asked me, looking at, I can't remember the name of it, but the last artwork in the final room of the exhibition, people asked me more than once if I was waiting for the elevator. And then the follow-up question was, is it a real elevator? So I just, I really loved that interaction with other people and sort of the space that the artist had created. And later when I was reading about the show, the artist made a statement in a previous interview in which he said that he didn't consider his artworks to be finished until people entered the space and interacted with them. And I thought that was pretty poignant, and it certainly spoke to my experience.
Carly, describe interactions that you had, either with the work or with fellow visitors, and well, did you feel that you were completing the artwork by seeing it?
Yeah, of course. While it invites you to attempt to be disoriented, which is the stated goal of the piece, I'm not sure if it was, I hadn't had lunch yet, but I did stumble out lightheaded, and there is this amusement park effect, and it's of a genre itself now with the Karsten Holler show coming to New Museum, where artists make these objects that we can attempt to navigate in kind of the appropriate way to leave feeling somehow changed. And a quarter of me loves this, and I don't know if it's just that I feel that.
As long as 75% of you doesn't detest it.
No, it's not detest it, but it feels somewhat neutral for the effort.
Right.
I feel like, again, it's to send you back to life, looking at, you know, pushing elevator buttons, perhaps, as this kind of exciting daily risk. And I wonder if I needed the incredible... I mean, to put it coarsely, expense and effort of having the sideways elevator to travel down like a rabbit hole to be able to wander out on the street again and look at elevators differently.
Right, right. Poseidon Adventure came to my mind, Ken. Did you have any sort of pop cultural associations with the sideways elevator, or where did it take you?
Oh, yeah, what was that movie? Inception.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But... I think for me there's a problem with the work because I don't know, it hasn't been explicitly stated, but the first elevator you walk in and it looks like an elevator's gone down into the floor, and in fact it's an illusion created with a mirror that it's actually reflecting what the ceiling, which reflector looks like a floor. And then there are six other elevators with what appear to be mirrored walls, but when you look into the mirror, you don't see yourself, so you realize actually you're looking into another reproduction. And if you've seen one of his pieces before, you know what to expect. But I remember I saw, I think, it may be the first time he did one of these in Soho at when Kent Gallery was there. And I walked in, and it looked like a waiting room, like a therapist's waiting room. And there was a mirror and this simple waiting room. And I just went, I walked out. And the dealer, Douglas, said, "Well, did you get it?" And I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, go back and look." So I go back and look, and I realized that what I thought was the mirror, I didn't notice that I didn't see myself in the mirror, was just the same room recreated in reverse, so it seemed like a mirror. Well, once that's been done, you can do it in lots of different ways. But once you know the trick, it's for people who've never don't know what to expect.
Right, right.
And they, I mean, he went to considerable expense, and the
ingenuity taste
and the elevators, it's all fabricated. It's he didn't just get canned elevators. So
probably a real elevator would cost a lot.
I'm very sympathetic to it, but I
why?
I feel what?
Well, you've just described that it's a one-liner, and that once you've got it, you've got it. So why are you sympathetic to
it? I love the one-liner, but
all right.
But
you have to go and persuade a lot of people who haven't seen it to go and see it, to join you in your enthusiasm, and then it's going to be like a Ponzi scheme. You're going to have to go and convert more and more people because there's going to be nothing left to give to the first investors, is there? Well, if it's a one-shot experience.
Right.
It must be said, it couldn't happen to a nicer guy. And in that sense, you think there's this trajectory of contact, like, yeah, he was showing in Soho and he's been doing this for many years and he's been in Williamsburg forever. So great that he just got to take over Sean Kelly Gallery. And in that sense, that's why I want to like the show, but that hasn't, not as, again, it has nothing to do with the fake elevator. And the most, what I could see was what was new was him constructing this shaft, which wasn't illusory. There was nothing illusory about the shaft, it was just weird to walk down this, you know, go under the narrow door. But again, you can point to other artists that have reconstructed buildings in ways that make you crouch down and come out the rabbit hole.
Yes, one could also think of Libeskind's Jewish Museum in Berlin as a I wasn't trying to make a joke, but as a comparable experience of claustrophobia inducing and disconcertingness of an elevator on its side. I mean, Ellie, the dealer at Kent, had to say to Ken, "Did you get it?" Now, with a joke, that's usually a bad sign. If one says, "Did you get it?" You've described in very pleasurable terms the interaction with other viewers and the and your personal experience with this show. But do you see the problem of depth?
I guess I didn't really think of it that way. I just lost myself in the experience and lived it and bought into it and really enjoyed myself.
Have you seen one of his works before?
No. I missed the swimming pool at PS1, I'm sorry to say.
Oh, that was very cool too.
And
that one actually surprised me. You walk up on this wooden deck and there's a small swimming pool about the size of the floor here, and it's kind of lovely, and you go in and you look down and you can see in, and then suddenly you see people walking around down below, and I like that a lot. So,
good.
But this one, I mean, it may be that he can. I don't think that playing with illusion and mirrors and that sort of thing is necessarily limited. That there, you could do more with it.
And
more different things with it. So
you could, yeah. There's the effects that he marshals, and then there's the affect of the overall, his overall sort of shtick. Now, mirrors, yes, there's an infinite number of things you can do with mirrors, but, I mean, usually with artists, they've got many ideas, and then there are forms that are sort of appropriate to their ideas. Now, here it's the other way around. He's a one-idea man, and he goes out finding the forms to match that singular experience.
Yeah, and then the part of the problem is that as with Steinbeck, the elevators are made with so lovingly and so perfectly. I have my own elevator story because in my building, which is 7 stories high, they put in new elevators, which was a 6-week process, and they actually look sort of like these.
Leandro's.
But there's the wood paneling and the stainless steel. I mean, there's a certain kind of attention to contemporary taste in elevators and in a certain kind of corporate reflection of corporate. So, you know, metaphor about the corporate world as a hall of mirrors is, you know, you could do something with that. So maybe it's not just a trick.
Yes. Carly, what about the video one with the Asian people in it? Does that take us to a different realm?
No. Sorry.
Okay. The answer was no. You've got to use your mic.
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
What was the question?
The question was whether the piece that has Asian business people inside the elevator as a video takes us to a different place.
Oh, when I saw it, they weren't Asians, I don't think. There might be different videos, but it's just not. You don't yet have the technology to create that kind of illusion enough. When we have it, hopefully he'll be onto it. And,
right. There's that guy who showed it. At Kasmin last year, I think we reviewed him here on the panel. The Las Vegas, the mirrors, and the trade. Who?
The various skyscrapers.
Yes, the.
Lozano.
No,
Navarro.
Thank you. With the trade towers, and you look right down, and boom. There's a lot to do with mirrors, of course. But. Okay.
I'm sticking up for my buddy Leandro.
Yes.
I think I wanted to go back to.
Did you go back?
To see the show?
Yes.
Saw it twice. Loved it again the second time.
Ah.
And I was thinking about.
So what was the difference of the second time then?
I just really wanted to investigate it further and physically experience it again. And I spent a lot longer the second time. I didn't, you know, there wasn't an opening. There wasn't really anyone else there. Actually, I think I went on a Saturday morning. And I wandered around the fake elevator bank, which was sort of 3 on one side, 3 on the other.
Yes.
And I mean, it sounds juvenile, but I was sticking my hand through one side and looking at it from the other. And it was so fun.
Yeah.
And so what I was thinking is you could say, okay, there's one joke, do you get the joke? Or he has one idea, once you're onto it, it ruins it. I didn't think so because, again, maybe this is me, but I'm a sucker for things like knock-knock jokes, you know? You never know what the punchline is going to be. Maybe you know you're hearing a knock-knock joke, but you can still laugh.
Yes, yes. I don't want to give the impression I'm overwhelmingly negative. I mean, I got what I got from the show. And I did really like the one on its side. And that had a kind of... No, that had a gravitas to it. I mean, to my mind.
That hallway was a shaft on its side.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's the shaft on its side. Didn't you think so?
I didn't get that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. It's got... Ah, you need to go back again. Yes. Because it's got the poles on the side.
Yeah, now so I get it.
That's
yeah.
why I said the Poseidon Adventure, because you know, it's the disconcertingness of...
To me, it recalled, let's see, Toy Story 2.
Toy Story 2, okay. We had Inception, Toy Story 2, Poseidon Adventure. Any movies? Okay. Okay.
But I think this whole thing goes to something, art today is thought of as experiential. Like, artists, the job of an artist is create an experience and hopefully sort of consciousness altering. And it was a cool experience, or it wasn't. At least that's what I think.
So you wanted like a spectacle experience then? Because I mean,
spectacle suggests something. Yeah, I guess it's
experience, really.
But you're immersed in it. Can you be immersed in a spectacle?
Right. I mean, there are so many immersive architectural installations, sure, that have like different aesthetic qualities. So you've talked about like the corporate. References, and you can go to the Huller whenever that opens, in a couple weeks, and have your different experiences. And then the other huge architect, you know, there's people like Gregor Schneider, and I'm forgetting the other person. More that you're in the building, you're in the structure, and things happen to you. And some are deliberately very degraded,
yes.
very...
And the British guy who did that...
Mike Nelson.
Mike Nelson,
yeah, right.
Yes, right.
So that's a much more, grungy, someone else's apartment.
That's a very rich experience, isn't it?
In theory, if you want to say, well, let's look at this also from the aesthetic side, you're looking at a certain kind, even the choice of an elevator. These are very clean objects, traditionally not. So I'm not sure how conscious the idea is to strip away... this, like, lived-in associations,
The Mike Nelson is like a Keenholz that you can walk through, whereas Leandro Ehrlich, I feel there's a...
But the problem I'm saying is that unlike, say, when, like, Greenberg was ruling the roost, that he had very clear criteria about how we judge... certain kinds of objects, and certain kinds of objects were the only kind of objects worth judging. And now we live in a world where, hey, it's a cool experience or it's not. There's clearly there's aesthetics involved, mm-hmm. but that's not, our judgments aren't based on aesthetics. The decline and fall of Western culture?
I concur with you. I mean,
but the coolness of the experience depends on the aesthetics as well.
Oh, so, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, but yeah. Sure, the criteria for judgment is not some.
But it depends on sort of kinesthetic, purely
movement.
Space and sort of illusion and all kinds of other.
It's a kind of gold standard of art. Perhaps that you're saying this has gone off the gold standard. Art's gone off the gold standard because you're saying, if I'm getting you correct, maybe in some past moment, an art object is something you could go back to over and over again. It would reveal new layers of depth and new layers of meaning, and it would change its meaning over time, and that would be the gold standard of art. And that if it is an art you go to and you burst out laughing or you burst out crying, you have an intense emotional experience, your consciousness has changed, but you can't have the same experience again. It's not necessarily a bad thing if it was an intense experience of a different nature.
Well, I think Carsten Haller had a part of his show in Germany. He was offering people psilocybin to enhance the experience. Probably won't go over very well here, but...
Suicide.
It does psilocybin.
Oh, I see.
Do you know what that is? It's the active ingredient in psychedelic mushrooms.
Oh, right. Yes. Okay. Okay. All right.
I mean, it brings to mind like a Philip K. Dick kind of art world future where, you know, we just have experiences.
Well, it's fascinating, actually, the way that you put it, though, because what it indicates is the incorporation of a cinematic experience into art, even when it's not cinematic art.
That's right. Yeah. Because actually that would be then my critique of the new kind of art that gives that experience is that it's... Okay, it no longer wants to compete with Titian because it's not going to give you this experience you go back to over and over again, but then it has to compete with a really great rock concert or a really good movie, and it usually falls flat. But anyway, I think it's time to bring in the audience, who must be ready to really let off steam here, and Steinbeck and Ehrlich. It's always a danger that the questions focus entirely on the last show one has looked at, but I think the aesthetic debate we were having there, I always love it when we have sort of meta-critical debate go beyond the show, so that's a good sign. That little debate about does it matter if it's not an experience you have to go back to over and over again, if it's a one-off good experience, that's also something be good to have some comment on. So that, Ehrlich, Steinbeck. So raise your hands and a mic will come to you, and please wait for the mic so that we can record you. Yes, you do. Otherwise, we won't hear you.
I just went to see the Leandro show last weekend, and I was listening to your comments in your discussion, and I agree with many things. I think one of the things is thinking back on it, there was this experience of the insulation lighting, for example, it's very dim, and there was a girl that was walking into one of the room or the elevators on the side. And I also didn't know at first that it was an elevator to the side. But she was short and she walked through this little door and I didn't really know what had just happened. It seemed like the wall had sort of swallowed her in, you know, because you have to duck down. I'm rather tall. I don't think it's a one-off in that sense. I think if I were to go back, you know, tomorrow, I would still have a similar experience, and it would also keep developing. And also that back room where the elevator you press in the video, when the door opens the video keeps changing, and it does keep... it begs you to ask what your perception of what is happening. I mean, it just doesn't... Also, if you don't press, it's a choice. If you don't press the elevator button, the door doesn't open. It doesn't just open on its own. At least I don't think so. So there is, I don't know, cinematic, but I mean, certainly the lights are lowered and it's not, you go up, you leave the gallery with a different sense. It's okay. It is a true
consciousness
experience.
Yeah. Raising
so,
and changing.
I don't know what I'm trying to say, but I feel that it was
good.
Just a one
Thank you very much. Thank you for sharing. Thank you. Yes.
I'm not an expert by any means, but both shows, from what I felt instinctively, they're both playing with your psychology. One is a pleasure button, and the other one's a fear button. The toys are pleasure, and the elevator's fear, and both have been decontextualized or something. And it's some kind of term like that, so that you're looking at something that is really just a pop pleasure or a real horror for a lot of us. Elevators scare the hell out of me. Every time I stand in one, it's awful. And so to turn it into this elaborate, elegant facade of reality is, and then to get, like Ellie was saying, how it turned people into conversationalists around something that's so scary, in the same way the Godzilla, the beast from, what was it, Black Lagoon?
Yeah.
The way, I mean, that's just pure pleasure. There's no fear in that. So I just, the whole thing seems to me like an art of psychology, rather than worrying about the materials and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Front row. Are we responding?
No, we don't have to.
It's just audience only.
We can. Hello. As you want to.
The thing I got about the Steinberg when I walked into the Creature of the Black Lagoon piece with Robert Morris was I just burst out laughing. But as you were talking, I started thinking about Erased de Kooning by Robert Rauschenberg. And so there's, for me, there was a great deal of humor along with this second level of bringing that kind of thinking into what we're doing in a contemporary way here. I don't know if you agree with that or not, but that's what I thought about.
Okay, thank you. It's good to hear thoughts. Yes, lady in the...
So I'm curious about this cinematic quality because my favorite moments in both of these shows reminded me of film. Seeing this creature in the middle of this white minimalist space, I agree, was hilarious and made me think of something like 2001 or like, you know, just that moment in the film where the music goes dun-dun. And then, however, it transformed, and suddenly I was looking at the details of the aesthetics of this strange creature because it was not in the slime at all. So I'm wondering if it's sort of cinema and then better. Mm-hmm. And in the elevator, in the Ehrlich show, going down that shaft made me think of any number of Wile E. Coyote cartoons where suddenly, you know, you're in an elevator that's about to crash.
Right.
But it was in slow-mo, so it was, again, like taking that cinematic moment and making you pause with it or something. I'm not sure.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for that. We'll take one more audience response at the back row, I think.
In the Ehrlich exhibition, the first elevator that we come into from the door, the one that looks like it's going down but there's the mirror, I noticed the gears on the outside seem to be painted in trompe l'oeil. And I didn't notice any other painting in the exhibition. And at first I found it odd. But from what you're saying today, it kind of makes me think about the mirrors, the lack of mirrors, the projections of the sky, projections into the other elevator, and this maybe he was thinking about reality and some of the ways that we can explore reality and the tradition of painting and realism. I don't know. It just seemed to be some of what you were talking about today.
Yeah, thank you. I noticed that as well. It was, to me, disconcerting. Okay, well, thank you very much. Look, in the interest of time, I mean, I think there are things we might want to pick up on, but I think in the interest of time, we should move on to the second half of the program.